Dr. Hazel Barton and Olivia Hershey. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Your work is in microbiology, and specifically cave microbiology. And Dr. Barton, I want to start with you. I know you've been in caves all over the world.
Uh-huh.
What keeps you coming back to South Dakota? Why the Wind Cave? Why the caves here?
I actually have a pretty long history with Wind Cave. So when I got my PhD, I was a graduate student in Colorado. And there was a long history of association between cavers in Colorado and the Black Hills. And so every month, the cavers from Denver would come up to Wind Cave, and we had something called the Wind Cave Project. And the survey that we did in the cave is one of the reasons the cave is as long as it is right now. I think there's actually, my name is on the wall there. I think I'm responsible for 3.41 miles of that. So I started coming here when I was probably Olivia's age. So I'm not going to say how long ago that was, but... Yeah, it's. I actually have a tattoo of Wind Cave on my body as well, so there's not many professors who can say that.
So if you get lost, you can look at the tattoo?
It is actually a route. It is a route from the entrance to the lakes, and I got it done before I'd ever been to the lakes. But yes, should we get lost, I know the way out.
And Olivia, have you had the chance to be into the lakes yet, or is this your first trip by chance?
My first trip was in October, so I have been there once already.
I've been to the lakes myself, and it's a five-hour trip just to get to the lakes. It felt like a marathon when I got out of there, and especially trying to keep up with the professional cavers at Wind Cave. Holy cow. Just to do this kind of science takes a lot. Can you talk a little bit about the trip to get just to get to the point where you need to start gathering samples?
I think it'll be better if Oliver describes it, because I was one of those cavers back in the day. I used to be able to fly through that cave because I knew it so well. But I think for somebody who's never been there and experienced it for the first time, I think that gives people a better idea of what it's like emotionally to do it.
It's a little stressful. Luckily, we have a really nice team of Sherpas that can take our equipment down for us. It's pretty interesting because you start on the tourist trail, so something that people, you know, come through all the time. They have all kinds of visitors, I think. How many visitors?
It's a couple of hundred thousand.
Yeah, a couple hundred thousand visitors per year, and they all get to see this trail, and you start on the trail, and you just walk off and just walk into the abyss, it feels like.
It's like three-dimensional running, I felt like,
yeah.
Because you're crawling, and then you jump up, and you're running, and then and then you go sideways through some crack, dive into your belly, and it's just... Wow.
Yeah, I like to do yoga. It's one of the ways. So you have to be physically fit, right? So I exercise a lot to stay in shape for this. And I had a yoga instructor, and I took her on a really easy trip, and she said it was like doing yoga in three dimensions.
Is that how you felt, Olivia?
I would say that's probably accurate. Yeah, lots of crawling to start with, and then climbing down the boxwork chimney is just like a squeeze. And you're climbing down and trying to put your feet on stable formations, so...
Every now and again you hear this, what am I supposed to do here?
Yeah, most of the time Hazel's ahead of me trying to describe how I should move myself, because I'm a fairly short person, I'm only 5'1", so a lot of people have much longer legs than I do.
And the reason you make this arduous journey to get to these lakes is because the water in the lakes contains rare cave bacteria. Can you talk a little bit about this water? I know you've said in the past, Dr. Barton, that this is some of the cleanest water on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a huge statement.
It is a big deal. It threw us off to begin with because we went down and sampled it like any other source of water. And we couldn't get anything out of it. We couldn't understand why we weren't seeing anything. And then when we finally counted what was in there, we found that it was lower than anything that had been described before. So that's what made it so difficult, but that's also what made it so interesting. And so we have been looking at the community and the structure of the community there. There's no higher life, right? So when we think about life on Earth, we think, you know, everybody gets the classic five kingdoms. And we know that's an inaccurate description now, but I'll use it for this. So you have the monera, which we would consider the bacteria, and then you have the protists, and then you have your animals, plants, your fungi. And so the simplest form of life that we belong to would be the eukaryotes, or these protists. And in every other aquatic system, they swim around and they kind of munch down on the bacteria. And that's what, you know, it's kind of the rabbit and the foxes at the microscopic level. But they're so starved in this environment, there's so few bacteria, there's no protists. So this last trip, we pumped, you know, liters and liters and liters of water just to say, are there really no protists in there? And there's not. So it's an ecosystem that is dominated by the bacteria. And that is, you can find it in other places, but it's only because the temperature prevents eukaryotic organisms surviving. This is something that's happening at room temperature. So this is incredibly unique.
Wow. And I remember you describing this as 1,000 times cleaner than tap water, the water in Wind Cave. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yeah. I don't want to put people off tap water, but it would be a lot easier to work with tap water than it is with the water from Wind Cave Lakes because it's so clean.
These bacteria that are there, they're valuable to study, I understand, for a couple of reasons. Why do you want to look at these bacteria?
Well, because it is a ecosystem that's dominated by bacteria, it's also competition is going to be at the level of bacteria. And so there's not a lot of energy to support them, right? We're deep. We're 660 feet underground. There's no energy from photosynthesis getting in there. The water does come in from the surface, but the fastest water coming in takes 27 years, and the slowest water takes 50,000 years. So no energy is coming into that system. So there's two ways. When you're in a situation where your food resources are scarce, you either work together to generate the food you need, or you cheat. And we're interested in the cheaters because there's lots of different mechanisms of cheating, and one of those is antibiotics. So we've seen lots of different types of cheating in that ecosystem. So we want to explore that as a potential for how we can maybe treat antimicrobial resistant infections.
And we've heard a lot about this in the press. Many people have the superbugs and the concern over antimicrobial resistance. But I'm confused because I always thought that antibiotics were, you know, they came from fungus, like the orange and the fungus on an orange. But how does studying bacteria then help you understand the stuff that fights bacteria, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, so I actually did it for a paper. It's 99.98% of all antibiotics are derived from natural resources. And of those, over 70% come from bacteria. So bacitracin comes from a bacillus, and streptomycin comes from streptomyces. So the majority of them actually come from other bacteria. It's actually less common to find them in fungi.
Wow, thank you. Are you seeing some promising results in your research?
We're going back in there this trip, so this is going to be, our 7th collection trip down in the lakes, and we're doing something that we haven't attempted before, and the park is going to help us do this. We're actually going to filter the water in the lake for 24 hours. So there's a couple of ways you can do this. We're actually going to go in, set everything up, leave, and keep our fingers crossed that everything's going to keep running through the night, and then return the next day. And that's because there's so few bacteria in there, it's very hard to get the DNA out. And so in the past, we've used amplification techniques to study it. What we'd like to do is go in, collect all the DNA, and sequence everything. So take all of it, and we call it shotgun sequencing. It's like, imagine you put it in a big gun and you shoot it at a machine, and the machine just sequences all the little pieces that come out. And then Olivia is going to reassemble that into a complete data set. And then what you can do is mine that information. And one of the things we're doing is working with a collaborator at Vanderbilt University. And there are little red flags that come up in the genome for the production of antibiotics. And you can put them together. It's almost like a Lego set. And how they go together is just like a Lego set, right? If you have this piece and this piece and this piece, you might make a car. So we can actually look at those Lego pieces in order from the genome itself and say, okay, there's something new. There's something we've never seen before. So that's what we're going to do. It's not 100% looking just for the antibiotics. We're going to be looking at a lot of evolutionary stories that the lakes could tell us because it's that bacterially dominated community that we can't see anywhere else. But, you know, when I'm explaining to my mom the importance of the research that we're doing there, it's very hard for her to get so excited about the evolutionary ecology of these lakes. But when I explain, we can look for these unique Lego sets and see if they tell us there's novel antibiotics down there, then she gets quite excited.
Wow. Well, a question on that evolutionary biology, this gives you, I guess, insight into life in the extremes, which I'm assuming it gives insight into life on possibly other planets, on the moons of Jupiter or something that have some water. Maybe down there somewhere there's similar systems. I don't know.
Yeah, I actually think it's a fantastic model for Europa. So Europa is an icy moon. It's capped with, I think they estimate, about 7 kilometers, so it's about 5 miles thick cap of ice. and we think that there's water underneath it, the ecosystem is shut off from all those surface processes we have on Earth. So it's going to be driven by geochemistry, and that allows us to look at what's going on in wind. And the numbers of cells are so low that, you know, they're so scant that I imagine if we can come up with a mechanism for looking for life at wind, then we could come up with maybe a technique that we could use on Europa. Now that is big sky science. I mean, that is, we would have to bring in lots of investigators from lots of different places with lots of different technical expertise. But, you know, this is the kind of stuff that there is potential to do at wind that there isn't potential to do anywhere else except maybe Joule.
Correct me if I'm wrong, I'm getting this right and understanding it right. You're going to take some equipment into wind that will suck up some water, mm-hmm. and run it through a filter and capture the bacteria, mm-hmm. and then drop that clean water back, yep. into the cave, mm-hmm. and then you'll take those bacterial samples out rather than having to take many, many gallons of water out of the cave, which
hundreds
is impossible.
Hundreds of gallons, yeah. of water, yeah. Yeah, no, we would be having people running from the entrance into the lake for months to do that, yes, and they would not be happy.
How do you keep the cave water clean? This is a pristine resource, obviously, that you want to protect as well, I'm guessing, the environment in itself.
Right. So the issue is whether when we're in there, things drop off us and they could, you know, maybe in damage the water. So we've actually done some studies, and it's shown that it's such a unique environment and so starved that whatever falls off us is just a nutrient and it's just immediately consumed. So we've done studies in other caves where people have dumped urine in the same spot for 30 years and we can't detect the microbes that are usually associated when we go to the bathroom, because they're just eaten. They just become a food source. When we go into the cave, we're very, very careful with the lakes. We basically use the same techniques a surgeon would use when he's doing surgery to minimize what's going back into the lakes. But it's a big body of water. I mean, it is connected to the Madison Aquifer. For some people, they might imagine it's like a regular lake where maybe water comes in from streams and fills it up. This is like more like a waterbed. And so when you have the groundwater, and when it rains very heavily in Wyoming, it's almost like somebody's pushing down on that edge of the waterbed and making the waterbed rise somewhere else. And that's what pushes the lakes up. So these lakes are connected to this, you know, massive aquifer that covers, I think it's 5 states in the U.S. and 2 states in Canada, so it's a ginormous body of water.
Madison Aquifer is incredibly important to all of Western South Dakota,
right.
as many
yeah.
will know.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier in passing that Joule Cave also has now just recently discovered Madison Aquifer lakes of its own, and this is incredibly exciting for many people in the Black Hills who are into caves, that there's now another window to the Madison. This has got to be exciting for you, too, as a possible another area of research.
Yeah, we've been already. I actually submitted the permit a couple of weeks ago to Joule Cave, and we've been talking to those guys. I'm fortunate enough to call many of the people involved in the exploration friends. So when it popped up in Facebook, you know, I was like, "Hang on a minute, this is kind of a big deal," and they knew it was a big deal too. So yes, we're absolutely gonna try and repeat it. Now, as hard as it is getting to the lakes and wind, that is a walk in the park compared to getting to where this is in Joule. I know I'll fit because I know the people going, and so I know that I'm smaller than they are. But when I've asked them, you know, do you think I could get out there, they kind of look at me, and you can tell by the expression on their faces. They don't want to say no. They do want me to go, but they know it's going to be an effort to get me there. And I'm used to this kind of caving. It's going to be brutal, I think.
It's about 5 hours into the Wind Cave Lakes. It's, I think, I'm guessing, a day and a half to get to the Joule Cave Lakes.
I went to the Wind Cave Lakes with one of the Joule Cavers, and it takes them about 45 minutes to get to the lakes and Wind Caves. So that's how fast they're moving.
Oh, no, it took me 5 hours. It took them 45 minutes?
45 minutes.
Oh, my
yeah.
goodness.
So you watch these people, it's like watching a ballet dancer move.
It's like deer running through the woods is how I describe it.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
unbelievable.
But it's just safe, right? Because, I mean, when we used to do it when we were at wind, and we caved at wind a lot. You don't fight the cave, you flow through the cave. And it's a real skill to be able to do that. And the level of fitness is crazy. So anyway, for those guys, I believe they were telling me it was somewhere between 7 and 9 hours for them. So okay. You can probably double that, more than double that for me. So I estimate if we did it, it would be a 48-hour trip just to get there, do some simple sampling and leave. Now, if we have to do a big sampling trip, we'll be down there several days.
Is this something you can send in some of the equipment and teach the cavers themselves how to get the water?
Yeah, those guys are pretty bright. So sure. I think that was actually one of our plans while we're here, is to go through some of the processes with them and show them how it works.
Do you expect to see different bacteria in Jewel Cave or than Wind Cave? Do you know? And there's another cave like in Brooks Cave, which is a much shallower cave in Dark Canyon.
Uh-huh.
Has anybody compared bacterial?
I don't know. I haven't heard about the Brooks Cave one. I think it would be fascinating based on where they are relative to the Black Hills and the Madison Aquifer. So as the Madison, you know, swings down south and then turns west, so Jewel's hitting it at a different point. I think if we need to understand a lot about the groundwater mixing at that area, and if we can do that, then we can either estimate that the bacteria are going to look very different or they're going to look the same. And whatever that is going to be really interesting as far as the science of it is concerned.
It's always great that there's more questions than answers often as these research projects go forward.
I know. I was so excited when I heard about the Jewel Cave Lakes, and then part of me went, oh, no. Oh, my goodness, there's just so much to do.
And what's next? Do you have some publications you're planning to put out on all of this research coming up here in the coming year? Is that right?
Yeah. So we have a publication. Then we were it's one of those things where I should have gotten it out 2 years ago, but we've had other work that we've been doing. But it's actually in my briefcase right now. I'm hoping to get it out next month. So yes, it'll be a nice paper. It beautiful, I think. Well, of course, I wrote it. Describes the work that we've been doing there and the importance of the microbiota. But it also sets the stage for all the future research. And I think when that hits the scientific community, there's going to be a lot more interest. And we're hoping that we can pull in some other researchers, maybe some NASA folks, and get them excited about the potential of the caves as well.
Well, we look forward to following this as the research goes forward. Dr. Hazel Barton and Olivia Hershey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting
us. Thanks for having us.